Right, so thank you all for coming to tonight's performance and also staying to participate in our discussion with our expert panel that we have here. Just really quickly, my name is Margaret. I'm a research fellow at the University of Warwick. I work on a Wellcome Trust funded project titled Prisoners, Medical Care, and Entitlement to Health in England and Ireland from 1850 to 2000. The project has two primary investigators, both of whom are with us here this evening, Hilary Marland from University of Warwick and Catherine Cox from University College Dublin. And you'll notice in your program you received this white piece of paper. It has more extensive bios of our expert panels for this evening, but I understand we are on tight time, so my intros are going to be very brief. So Catherine and Hilary's research, as Hilary mentioned, was part of the used in the production of this show. It was collaborated with a Coventry-based theater group, Talking Birds, and we have one of the co-founders here, Derek, at the end of the table there. He's also the composer, so when you find yourself singing 13 by 7 by 9 over and over again, you can curse that man's name. And finally, rounding out our panel of experts for this evening is Annie Bartlett. She's a forensic psychiatrist. She's had an extensive career in forensic psychiatry and the criminal justice system, and is currently, among a number of responsibilities, clinical director for the Health and Justice Program for NHS England. So I'm really excited to be facilitating this discussion tonight, partly because of today. So today is World Mental Health Day. And the production this evening brought to light aspects of mental health in a setting that's often ignored or often or understudied when we think about mental health. So I will start off the discussion with a question of my own, joining some of the themes from the discussion based of World Mental Health Day and our production this evening, and open it up for you, which is, what perspectives on tackling the issues of mental health in the prison do you think are brought out by the play? And to follow up and to broaden a little bit more, how do you see the play having an impact on awareness of mental health more broadly?
I mean, I think for me, as someone who's worked for quite a long time within the English prison system, one of the things that we are painfully aware of is that conditions in prison are deteriorating at the moment, and that that has an impact in a general sense on people's mental health. And I think the second thing, which is, if you like, about the very extreme nature of the regime we saw depicted, which is not, in my experience, how it is in the UK, it did highlight for me something that is very well recognised and is a worry, particularly with very fragile people, which is that if you are subject to sensory deprivation for periods of time, and they may even be quite short periods of time, certainly not the sort of 12, 18 months that we've just heard about, that is likely to have an impact on your mental health. And indeed, you almost potentially replace the things that you would ordinarily have sensed, you know, that you would have touched, that you would have heard, you would have had conversations, you would have seen things, you would have moved around. And actually your mind in a way plays tricks on you. And so you invent, companions in your cell with whom you can have conversations. If only it was as benign as that. I think in my experience, those experiences are very distressing. They're not neutral. They're not chatting to the hare. Whether that, you know, who knows what that chap thought? Who knows? But they result in considerable distress. So those are my initial observations from what I've heard.
Well, I suppose speaking as a historian, what do I think it? I think first of all, it has helped people actually think about the prison, as you said, Margaret, as a place where people have mental health issues. I think, you know, those of us that are, you know, maybe read the work of people like Annie and others, or are involved in various organisations like the Howard League or the Irish Penal Reform Trust, you know, you're sort of quite aware of it. But for others, for people who sort of just maybe come in off the street into a play, they're not aware of the problem of mental disorder in our current system, and indeed they're not quite aware of the long history it has, both as a system that could exasperate maybe existing issues, or individuals who just end up in the system because other services have been or are inadequate. So I think for broadening that out to a more general audience that maybe aren't aware of these issues, I think it's actually been very very interesting and very helpful. And I think, as I'm talking as a historian here, I think a lot of people are quite familiar with the Pentonville system, with the separate system, Bentham, all those type of issues. But having spoke to a number of my colleagues who are familiar with 19th century history generally, they were not aware of the link with mental illness, the sort of high numbers of cases of insanity that came out of the system. They were, aware of the more broader Foucauldian sort of debate around the prison system, but not that. That story was less well known. So I think it's been quite interesting in that respect.
Mm. I don't really think I have much more to add. You've both summed it up beautifully. I mean, we were very, very interested, of course, as both Annie and Catherine have emphasised, to pick up on this idea of solitude and isolation. But I think the decision was made during the production of the play, and the director and scriptwriter, Peter Kahn, isn't with us tonight, but we did discuss this, and it was discussed in rehearsals as well, that not to put anything really, to make the link with today explicit. We really wanted the audience in a way to make that connection. But it was quite striking to us as researchers, not only to see the parallels about sensory deprivation, but when we are lucky enough to access prisoners' records and memoirs, the way that prisoners describe themselves, their own experiences of being in a cell on their own in the 19th century, did reflect and match very closely, incredibly closely, the sort of language that is used in reports today, which is based on prisoners' testimonies. So we were very struck by those connections with the people who experienced these systems of punishment as well.
Just one more thing for me, then I promise I will open it up to all of you. But Hilary, you just mentioned the extensive amount of documents and research that you had shared with Talking Birds in this collaboration. So just a quick question directed mostly at Derek, which was, what is it like collaborating with academic researchers in creating a theater piece?
It's great. It's great because, I mean, we work a lot as a company with historical material, and to get material that's been curated and pulled together and analyzed and is a real rich resource. And what we want to do is get things truthful, get them as truthful as you can, if it's not literally true, but it's the other aspect of the collaboration is the kind of interrogation and the conversation about what we include, what we don't include, mm-hmm. what would slightly skew it. And so that's always that's a process that happens in rehearsal room for any show, but to have that added rigour, I think actually makes for a better, and because this also has it's quite purposeful, this work, because it's about getting this research out there in a form that's perhaps more accessible than a academic report, and those obviously have their place, but in terms of the wider world, and that's what we want to do. We want to reach audiences. So there's a kind of common purpose.
Following up on what Derek was saying, to reaching a broader audience, we of course want to hear from you and questions that you have about the performance or deriving from themes in the performance. We have a microphone that Flo can bring around. Please raise your hands. We're happy to have any type of questions for our expert panel this evening.
Yes, I enjoyed the show, so well done there. I'm just wondering about the relevance today. I remember seeing a film with Kevin Bacon, Murder in the First. I think it was based on a true story that in Alcatraz, when it was open, he was in solitary confinement for 2 years. Are there any instances now in the British prison system where there's a kind of punishment where there are people are put in solitary confinement?
Do you want to pass that one down there?
Yeah, I mean, I should say at this point that I'm a healthcare person, not a prison person in the sense of prison discipline. But yes, I mean, you know, solitary confinement, cellular confinement is part of the range of potential punishments available in English jails. You know, so your punishment might be that you lose your access to your canteen, to the things you want to buy for yourself. It might be that you are confined to a cell for a couple of weeks, depending upon what it is that you are said to have done. That's in contrast, I think, to what we've heard tonight. One of the things that came through for me was that this was a wholesale regime. And curiously, I mean, it seems an odd thing to say, perhaps, but it didn't seem to me that the intention was that the regime was punishing. It was to encourage, you know, kind of self-reflection and you would emerge a better person at the end of it. There is no doubt that cellular confinement as used today in the English system is intended to be a punishment for an infringement of the prison rules. So that's conceptually perhaps a kind of really important difference. If I might just continue for a second, the thing that makes you think that what we have here pales into insignificance is my understanding of the American supermax regimes. And other people in the audience may know much more about that than I do. But that is essentially a system that is pretty much on a par with what we saw tonight, that the intention is to be deprived of contact with other human beings and the things that might make life bearable. And I think we all saw pictures on our screens at Guantanamo Bay, and I thought at that time, in my innocence, that was an unusual regime. And I am not any longer convinced that that is such an unusual regime, and I think aspects of it are a regular feature of the American imprisonment system, the industry that is imprisonment. So I think there are really interesting issues of degree, to answer your question, you know, around what different jurisdictions have and what they call them as well.
And I think another phrase used as well is restricted regimes. So this is, you know, some people are put in for their own protection, that they ask to be separated and from the general prison population as well. So as you say, they have there are different phrases and there are different prompts for people to be sort of separated out from the general prison population like that.
And I think the other aspect to mention, there was a report recently about wormwood scrubs in London, and the report found that many prisoners were kept in their cells 22 hours a day. And that was probably less to do with punishment, but more to do with the lack of resources within the prison and the lack of opportunity to take prisoners out of their cells for exercise or to participate in activities. So there are different forms of confinement in the cell, and some are probably more to due to a lack of resources and overcrowding in some prisons, which is a huge problem, of course, and a growing problem.
Yeah, I think there's one or two up there. I saw you back there as well. I got that, yeah.
Thank you very much. That was a very compelling presentation, and yeah, very, very interesting. So thank you for that. I was wondering, your main research questions, how do you feel they played out in this presentation, or were you able to kind of, I wonder how this connects to your research. How did the main findings come out in this presentation, or your main questions or main theory? Thanks.
Well, I mean, one of the amazing things about working with Talking Birds and with Peter Kahn is we give Peter, who writes the script, a lot of material to work with. We select it. We don't give him too much because he would be there for years. And then we meet with him. We have conversations with him. But at no point do we really say, we want you to address this. this is what we want you to talk about, this is what we want you to come out in the play. But somehow Peter distills our main research questions out of the material. It's a really interesting process, and that's why this is the third piece of work we've actually done with Talking Birds. So we're quite used to each other now. We collaborate quite well. And I guess we, apart from the impact of the solitary system, we were also very interested in this question of what prison does to the prisoners, what it does to people who also have existing mental health problems when they go into the prison system, as well as it actually producing mental illness. You can't answer these questions very specifically for the historical past because, you know, we don't have numbers. There's all sorts of ways that the prison system adapted the information about mental illness because they were very keen, of course, to protect their regime. But I think that interplay between the prison systems and mental illness was something, obviously, that came out really well in the play, and it's kind of the core, really, of our research.
And I suppose the other issue that came out is the sort of the role of the three characters, the chaplain, the medical officer, and the school teacher, and how, you know, they are sort of interacting, they're debating, they're negotiating all these issues. It's not one single blanket imposition of a system, and there are those that are pushing back and those that are more enthusiastic. In this case, obviously, the chaplain, I think we can say. But, you know, that can vary from prison to prison, from country to country. It's nuanced, it's changed. And I think Peter and Talking Birds also drew out that issue of the complicated position of somebody like the medical officer. Are they there to uphold the discipline? Are they there to protect their prisoner patients? And I think that was drawn out quite nicely as well, which is another issue we were interested in.
I was wondering, I was really interested by the way literacy and illiteracy kind of played a role in the way the performance kind of played out. And I was wondering whether that is a reflection of what you find in prison staff's texts of the time, if you know what I mean. Do they see kind of more mental health problems among literate people, or was that kind of a coincidence in the play, if you see what I mean? Sorry, it's a little convoluted question.
Well, I think, Annie was talking about the more positive aspects of the regime, and it's true that what she said about it intending to be reformative and to really, the prisoners initially, once they left the prison, as the play made clear, would be transported, and the prison wanted to not only reform them and redeem them, but also to improve their skill set. So one of the ways they did that was through teaching them the three R's. And this was something the chaplains recorded in quite a lot of detail. They marked the improvement of the prisoners who came into the prison unable to read and write and left, in some cases, with some level of literacy skills. And they were also taught a trade as well at Pentonville. So part of the intent of the prison was to make the prisoners more literate. I think where we come across that, the sort of nuts of your question about the relationship between kind of literacy and education and mental illness is when we read prison memoirs, which of course are written by the well-educated literate prisoners. And they describe their experiences of being deprived of literature in quite striking ways, and how important it is for prisoners who can read and write to have good access to this kind of material. I'm not sure we're able to really say there are any
correlations
because the figures wouldn't really, there aren't really very good figures, and I'm trying to recollect if it's something the prison staff talk about extensively.
School teacher maybe.
Picks up on this relationship between someone who will suffer more through being deprived of access to reading materials and other kinds of stimulus.
Thank you very much. I was really interested by this presentation. Thank you so much. Because I remember reading somewhere that men are more than three times as likely as women to be imprisoned. So I was really interested by the fact that we had a cast of three female actors tonight. And I wondered about the decision behind that casting and the gendered implications of the piece in terms of prison gender relations.
Yeah, thanks for your question. Well, I suppose the stories are about men, but also about the women that are absent in the story. So there's that aspect of, like the song, partway through about the wives, mothers, lovers, and the impact there. So the sort of, yeah, I describe it as secondary punishment to take on another a phrase. And I suppose, there were decisions about casting which were partly pragmatic. This is the third of a trilogy, so we've had a common thread of performers. Well, Jill has been in all three, Teresa's been two, Jen's been in this third one. So there was that. We wanted a common thread, partly because we want to perform the three together at some point, so there was a... but then when it came to the the crunch of casting, it's like we wanted to portray a lot of different characters and actually felt like if we had one man in there, that might kind of limit us as to the freedom in terms of, or like we might get hooked in some sort of literal portrayal, which we never tried to do anyway, but it felt like also it might provide a little bit of distance on the material that would really be helpful as well. So it's a mixture of those motives and I'm interested to know what you thought was the effect, I suppose.
Well, I was really interested, and it was in no way, my comment was in no way intended as a criticism of gender blind casting. I thought it worked really well, and it made us kind of think more about the gendered implications of the prison system. But also there's possibly another interesting gendered element, which makes us, I think, automatically, for various social and cultural reasons, we are more likely to sympathise with women than men. And so the fact that we are now kind of looking at this piece, which is kind of presenting this kind of verbatim theatre of the thoughts and emotions of prisoners, it helps us to see another side to the prison system, which I think is really important. And whether intentional or not, I thought that was really effective. So thank you.
And just a really small addition to that, there are two prisoner memoirs that were drawn on particularly in the script, and some of the small amounts of text were actually produced verbatim, and those were both written by women who were observing on, you know, the experiences of prison, on other women prisoners, of course. So it's quite interesting that some of the script actually refers, there are references specifically to women prisoners.
I wonder if I could invite you to kind of expand a bit more on what you touched on previously about the different roles, the different staff roles. I felt the portrayal was very much that there was quite a critical perspective of the religious side of the prison, but maybe not such a critical side on the doctor side and the kind of mental, maybe the psy aspect of it. And I was wondering if that was, so there's interesting questions there around power and control and all the rest of it. And I was curious if you could possibly expand a bit on, was that an accurate portrayal of what you found in your work, or is that maybe an interpretation to the end bit, or was that really quite much what you found, that there was very much this benevolent role from the medical side, but religious side was a bit more critical?
Well, I'll start. Well, pass it quickly to Catherine. There was huge variation, I think, in the records we read. But the chaplains were, by and large, the forefront of the system of discipline. So they were great enthusiasts for it, and pressed for it quite hard in terms of its introduction and then its implementation. And indeed, the first chaplain at Pentonville was let go because of his overzealous preaching, which was said to encourage an outbreak of religious mania. Doctors we know a little bit less about. They didn't have much of a training in psychiatry, that much we do know at this period. Later in the 19th century, more, I think. And the system in Ireland, which I mean, the play is also based on Irish prisons, was a little bit different, I think.
Yeah, I mean, when the system gets to Ireland in 1850, so Pentonville 42, Mountjoy 1850, by then they're sort of toning down the role of the chaplain because they're sort of conscious, I suppose, of some of the evidence that's coming out. Mm. They're not ignoring. But of course, when you have our religion in the Irish context, things just get messy. So, you know, you've got prisoners of different faiths and, you know, you're meant to only have one chaplain, but then you have two chaplains because you have to have all most faiths represented, basically. And then it becomes three when you're in an area with high Presbyterian. So it becomes adjusted that way. And then you actually have tensions, of course, between them as well, the individual chaplains and the type of reading they're providing, because if they're providing reading that's very critical of the other faith, then they're concerned that the prisoners themselves, once they're in association, will start tension. So the chaplain's role, I think, is slightly reconceived when it's moved to Ireland. Likewise, their relationship and oversight of the school teacher is also adjusted accordingly as well. The doctors, again, they can be just very different. They can really, I mean, sometimes you read the sort of extracts from a medical officer's journal from one prison, and it's, you know, somebody who's very enthusiastic, shall we say, of the system. Another time, it's quite critical. So there's just a lot of variation and a lot of adaption as you move, not just between country, but between prisons.
Can I just add?
Go ahead.
I just want to very briefly to say that I think the position of doctors or indeed clinical staff who work in prisons now, as then, is full of moral ambiguity. Mm-hmm. And that not to wrestle with that is a sort of dereliction of your duty as a healthcare professional. And I thought actually tonight's performance really hinted very strongly at the sort of moral conflicts for the doctor, who seemed to me ultimately to have acted on concerns, whilst also essentially, I think, in terms of employment, being part of a regime. So one of the interesting things about the English system later on, I suppose, in the 20th century, was that doctors who worked within prison were employed by the prisons, not by the NHS, and that's no longer the case. And they were people who perhaps wouldn't have done so well in other branches of medicine and found a place in a system where, to be frank, clinical standards were very poor. And that's just the beginning of the kind of questions about medical and other clinical roles in places of imprisonment.
I mean, I think it's a fabulous point and something that we can discuss for an incredible amount of time, but I am going to apologize to the couple of you who had hands up. We're just on a very tight time scale tonight, but I will encourage all of you that I believe the bar is staying open. Our panelists are willing to talk about this for hours, especially if you buy them drinks. But I'm going to encourage you to, first of all, thank our speakers and then continue the discussion outside.